Our guest is Andrea Barnett, the author of the just published book Visionary Women, Echo Press. It came out in March?
Yeah.
March. And this is March. May. So yeah, just pretty much get a little closer to the microphone.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Can you hear yourself well?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
I can.
And the four women who are the subject of the book are Rachel Carson, Jane Jacobs, Alice Waters. Oops, I got one out of order. Jane Goodall. Now, you'll be surprised to know that in a Common Council meeting the other night, I actually quoted Jane Jacobs from your a quotation from your book that was not from Death and Life of American Cities, but from her article that she wrote for Forbes.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Tell me which.
The one where she talks about revitalization being like a cemetery, you know?
Right. Yeah. The cities will be
dead
as cemeteries.
Because we have a big project that kind of, you know, she would be appalled by that's in the works, but I won't go into it. Anyway, so the big, I guess the first question really is how do you see those four figures as being doing the same sort of thing? And what is it that they did that makes them aligned?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about these four women is they were in different fields. They didn't know each other. They're different generations, but it turns out they have an enormous amount of in common. All of them were green thinkers before green had entered our collective vocabulary. All of them changed the way we think about a swath of the world. Rachel Carson about the environment, Jane Jacobs about cities and historic preservation, Jane Goodall about our relationship to animals, and Alice Waters about food and eating. All of them were outsiders. They were uncredentialed. Goodall and Jacobs didn't even have college educations. They waded into their fields and their respective fields and got their hands literally and figuratively dirty. All spoke truth to power at a time when women had no voice. Women were supposed to make coffee, not decisions. And all prevailed.
Remember that, Ellen? You remember those days?
I forgot it already.
Forgotten how to make coffee. It's a good thing to forget. And all had their breakthrough moments, with the exception of Alice, in the 60s, at a time when the culture was really resetting its moral compass, and it was just as the second wave of feminism was breaking. But also it was a sort of moment where there was a crack in the culture where new ideas and new voices were welcome.
Let me stop you there for a second, because you mentioned feminism. You know, there's also another recent book that kind of coalesces with this one by Michelle Dean. Do you know that
right,
name?
Right.
And interesting about those characters, as well as yours, none of them really wanted to identify as feminists.
It's the same with these women, except for Alice, who is a little bit younger.
Right.
Rachel Carson wouldn't have understood that idea at all. She was so intent on her work. She was so deeply committed to getting out a message before she died, because she had cancer as she was writing Silent Spring. She was supporting a family. She was enormously poor. She was supporting five members of her family. So she wouldn't have, the only thing that would have gotten in her way was the fact that as a scientist, she was never sent out to the field. She would have been allowed to. So she had to edit the reports of male scientists, which is one of the reasons she became a writer. It was the only way that she could support herself. And in fact, the reason she knew about DDT early on is she was editing an early field report that the U.S. government had conducted about DDT. But so she didn't identify as a feminist. It wasn't really a word. Jane Jacobs also scoffed at any ideology and all labels. She was a thinker. She was really smart and really a master tactician.
And yet many people think of her as kind of a libertarian, don't they?
Yeah. It's funny. Both the left and the right claim her as their own, which is funny.
Yeah.
And Goodall, of course, what Goodall says is, I read books and I imagined myself in as a male as well as a female. It didn't seem to be. She grew up in a household of women. Her father was an absentee father, went off to the war and never really returned. And she was surrounded by her mother, her grandmother, her aunts, and they were all, she was never told that as a girl she couldn't do things, except maybe in high school. And so she didn't identify that way either, and still really doesn't when you ask her.
Oh, so you've managed to talk to the two living members
of your book. I did. And, yeah, it was quite thrilling because especially Jane Goodall speaks with such conviction and in perfect paragraphs, and she sort of lives the work she does and lives the ideas. And when I interviewed her, it was right before Christmas, and my dog kept walking back and forth behind me, which is quite funny because I said, excuse my dog. But we talked for hours. And, you know, it's very hard once you interview someone like that to know whether you're getting any really original material. Mm-hmm. But she said everything so well. And so maybe I got a few things that, you know, she hasn't said.
That's interesting you mentioned original material, because all four of your subjects have had biographies written of them.
That's right.
So that the whole idea was, I suppose, to reimagine their lives from existing, you know, secondary sources and figure out something beyond that.
Right. I was looking for the connective tissue between them. And this is basically a biography of a paradigm change, a real change in consciousness. All of them were pushing back against the values and priorities of the 1950s, the culture's love affair with science-based technology, the disconnection, increasing disconnection from nature, the deference to big business, the, you know, deference to the military. And so I was looking for common themes, sort of the common threads. So I told their stories with that in mind, trying to shine a spotlight on those moments of that sort of spotlighted the quirks of their character, but also the moments that were very much like each other. And so I told their stories, and I also only told their stories in depth up to the 1960s, which is kind of where my story culminates. And the rest, their later activism, I summarize.
And that's because, as your subtitle suggests, you see them as having, quote, changed the world.
Yeah.
And that's when it happens. I mean, you know, they continued to be active in their fields, but, well, Rachel Carson died relatively young, but that's really the moment when there's something, they influenced a lot of others.
Right. They really changed the way we think about their fields. And what's interesting is all of them were extraordinary communicators and all put a personal face on very complex questions about the nation's future. They were unafraid to write using personal anecdote and in the first person, and they understood that people will only protect what they love. And so they tried to write in a way that that expressed their own passion but also expressed their concerns. And it was that sort of personal quotient that broke through. It wasn't, I mean, Rachel Carson's subject was enormously complicated and technological. I don't even know. But the chemistry and things behind pesticides were really, really hard to understand. What she was able to do was to make it into a human story.
And that's why, I mean, that was the basis of a lot of the criticism, was that they were uncredentialed and weren't writing in the standard sort of objective scientific method.
Right, right. They weren't using theory.
And that spoke to their being women.
Right, right. And being untrained outsiders, being women. And because they didn't know the theory, they didn't speak in it, and they didn't see the same things that those who had been schooled in the theory saw. They went in kind of tabula rasa.
And Jane Goodall, probably most extreme, began her research without even a college education and defied all the rules of ethnography or ethology, whatever they call that study.
No, her story is incredible because she went completely unschooled, untrained. She had no background in primatology. She'd been Louis Leakey's secretary. He was a skirt chaser, so he'd hired her because she was pretty. But he'd noticed that he'd asked her to accompany him on a dig the first summer she worked for him. And he noticed she had this enormous concentration and patience. And he began to see, and also that she seemed oblivious to really difficult heat and lack of food, and she's just, her endurance was extraordinary. And he started to think, maybe a woman, he had wanted to send someone out into the field to study wild chimps, because he thought that was the key to understanding early mankind, the origins of humans. And he saw Goodall and he thought, maybe an untrained outsider with this sort of patience and this sort of quietness might be better than a man. And so against all odds, he was able to raise money, which he went to all conventional sources. Everyone laughed him out of the room and said, are you kidding? Someone who's untrained, who's a woman, we're not sending her there. So he ended up going to this sort of wacky Midwesterner who was a tool maker and had fallen. It was smitten by Leakey, who was an expert on Stone Age tools, and world famous already as an anthropologist. But he gave these performances where he'd slaughter a live elk with Stone Age tools. And anyway, this wacky Midwesterner was at the convention and thought, this guy is great. Yeah. And so he began to finance Leakey's expeditions. And so Leakey went to him and said, I've got someone really wonderful for this chimp study I want to do, not saying that she was untrained. And he got the money and sent her. And so back to your question, Goodall got there with no idea how to go about it. And so what she did was she followed the sounds of these chimps for weeks and months, and she just tried to habituate them to her presence enough so she could start to identify them. And she started to record everything she saw because she didn't know any better. And she didn't know that the theory at that time was that chimps had no intelligence, no sentience, no will, that they were mechanical, almost like clocks. And she had always had pets. She loved animals, and she gave them names, the chimpanzees she was watching, because she didn't know better. It was unprofessional, but she needed to be able
Ellen
to
does that. Ellen loves to name all her animals and the ones outside in her yard.
I have two animals.
Well, no, the ones that float around your neighborhood there, you have names for them all.
Oh,
don't
you mean the bad guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it's probably a good idea to give all moving things names. But anyway, yeah, she was completely untrained, and she, you know, it was this incredible perseverance and keen powers of observation. I mean, that's the other thing all of these women shared, is they were highly observant. That just happened to be their bent.
But the key ultimately is her two sort of major discoveries, that they use tools, and what's the other one?
That they eat meat.
Oh, that they eat meat. That's what I think,
Yeah. The discovery of the tools was really interesting, because she was walking one day in the forest, and she saw this brown mound that she thought was a stump. And then she looked more closely, and she realized, no, it's a chimpanzee, and he's doing something in front of him. So she ducked down quickly. And she began to realize it was a termite mound, and he was breaking off pieces of hay or of grass and poking them into the termite mound and then pulling out termites. So effectively, he was using the grass as a tool. And so she wrote Leakey and said, I think I've seen this. And then she witnessed it for a few days running and realized, yes, there was, you know, there was real intention in how they were doing it. And she called it termite fishing. Completely revolutionized the world, because Leakey had said, tools make the man. So if chimpanzees were making tools, what were they? They weren't men, but they weren't maybe clocks either.
And even when this was, even when she presented her material, there was still resistance from the Academy.
Totally, totally. She was a woman in the...
Perceived as anecdotal.
Yeah, yeah. In those days, if there were any women at scientific conferences, they were in skirts and little pillbox hats with veils. The protocol was that anyone asking a question asked the sort of major domo, and then he would direct the question to the scientist. And he kept ignoring all the questions that were directed toward Jane. He dismissed what she said. He said she was trafficking in anecdote and emotion, and she couldn't possibly have seen chimpanzees eating meat or using tools. And in fact, she had documented by this time at length and written papers and was known in the scientific world as someone who'd seen that. But she had to fight that for years, being marginalized as a woman.
You also suggest that the fact that they were women may have sort of contributed to the breakthroughs that they came up with.
Yeah, without being too essentialist about it. It's a very fine line.
Yeah, I know. That section is like, this is interesting, but maybe a little dubious.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think because they were outsiders, mm-hmm. because being women, they were outsiders, and being outsiders, they came with a very fresh perspective. They not only saw different things, but they saw things differently because they hadn't been trained. So, and they were keenly observant, as I say, and also they were very grounded in the physical, and they trusted their senses. They weren't afraid of their intuition. They weren't afraid of the subjective. And so they were using all of their bodies in a way to look at the world. And they were drawing on lived experience rather than received information and theory, which was a very different approach, a different orientation. They were all discoverers, and they were sort of identifying what was hiding in plain sight. And the thing is, when you go to a problem with the theory, you look for evidence that supports the theory. They didn't have a theory, so they were just recording what they saw. And in fact, Jacob said, I don't make my mind up about the world and then look for evidence to support it. I look at the world, and when I begin to start seeing patterns, I then begin to draw my conclusions. It's a very different approach. And so I think because they were women, that happened to be their approach, but that was because they were not part of the status quo, probably not because of their DNA. Men could do that too.
And Rachel Carson seems to be the most reticent in many ways. I mean, she wasn't really an activist, even right. though her research led to many activists
right.
you know, following in her
she
path.
She was painfully shy, extremely reticent. Many people don't know that before Silent Spring, she was a beloved best-selling nature writer. Her books about the sea were bestsellers, and she could never understand why magazines wanted to write profiles about her life, and she was mortified by that. She didn't want anyone to. She felt that the work was enough. Her agent was always saying, "Rachel, you have to go to more book events. You have to circulate." And it was painful. And anytime she had to speak publicly, which she did a lot, she'd write everything out on note cards and, you know, read from the note cards in a kind of monotone voice. She just was. It was very painful to be in the public. On the other hand, she believed so strongly in her message, in terms of Silent Spring, that she was willing to really go out and promote it. And one of the things she realized was her audience was women, because women were very concerned about the safety of their mm-hmm. children and the, you know, strict post-war division of the sexes, which had sort of stranded a whole generation of women in the suburbs, was her ideal audience. They all had vegetable gardens. They were all really in charge of the children. She'd go to garden clubs and speak about Silent Spring. She'd go to groups of women journalists, and she, because the chemical companies were mounting a very concentrated smear campaign against her, and they had circled the wagons, raised a huge amount of money, and in order to counter that, she had to go out on the road. But she was never happy with it, never comfortable.
And so our listeners understand, we're talking about her Silent Spring really sort of popularizing the problems with DDT, which
right.
now we barely think about, but at that point was everywhere. It was
right.
being, they were driving through the streets spraying trees and
right.
yards. I mean, just, you even have a personal anecdote about remembering
right.
it from your childhood.
Right. Now, that's such a good point to bring up. At the time she was writing, they were doing mass aerial spray campaigns over three states at a time. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres were being sprayed with DDT. In neighborhoods everywhere in the suburbs of New England and the South, there would be fogging trucks that would just pump out this toxic poison. And children played in the fog. And I actually remember seeing, you know, the trucks coming through. It was all part of anyone who had a childhood in the 50s. And no one really questioned this, because the idea was the technology had saved the world for democracy in the war, that these chemicals had been developed during the war. They'd been enormously helpful to the soldiers. They'd killed lice and all kinds of diseases like typhus. And it was assumed that, you know, the future was our, all these technologies would bring us a new, more beautiful future. And so they hadn't, these chemicals really hadn't been tested for mm-hmm. how they affected humans. So she was the first one. She saw the reports, because she was working at the Fish and Wildlife Service. She saw that they were enormously, that they were changing the sex organs of amphibians, and they were killing fish, and that DDT was working its way up through the food chain, and she realized no one had done any tests on humans, but they were already discovering that humans already carried a load of DDT in their bodies, and that things like birds' eggs weren't hatching, and it affected their reproductive organs. And so she was the first one to kind of tie it all. The information was out there. in various siloed ways. But she was the first one to sort of knit it all together to make it a story that everyday people could understand, and to say these chemicals are enormously dangerous, not only to the ecosystem, but to human health, and that we really need to know more about them before we do this sort of mass spraying. And it really did change. I mean, almost overnight, people were so shocked that they began to demand some kind of accountability from the government and the chemical companies.
And I guess one of her real talents was her ability to read technical material and translate it into readable prose. And the story of how she comes to be a New Yorker writer is yeah. pretty inspiring,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, it's amazing. No, she could wade through this dense, dry technical information, pages and pages of it, and sort of distill it down to the sort of kernel of sense that she could communicate in everyday language. And she was a very beautiful and lyrical writer. So when you read Silent Spring, which I'm not even sure I had when at the time it came out, but when I read it again, it's so beautifully written and it's so moving, even though it's shocking. And so that was her there was a kind of alchemy there where she could turn this dry science into beautiful and startling stories and reach people.
And her work is now in the Library of America, right, which is kind
right.
of a testament to its endurance.
Right. I think Silent Spring has never been out of print.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as you say, and it's been 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was incredible in that she did understand the science, and she was patient enough. People spoke about her endurance. She would spend, you know, all night, you know, working in her same chair, pouring through this dense material until she got what she wanted.
Right. And I mean, at the end, she was in later stages of cancer that would eventually kill her, and yet she still showed up to the government hearings.
Yeah.
I mean, she still felt she wasn't an activist, certainly in the sense that Jane Jacobs was, but these appearances mattered. Her CBS interview
right.
was watched by millions and really did have great influence.
She was so courageous. She was dying of cancer. About halfway through the book, she discovered that she had cancer. She'd had several nodes taken out of her breast, and she'd been told by the medical profession that nothing had metastasized and that she was fine. And that was, again, that wasn't true. But in those days, a doctor, if you were married, the doctor would say to your husband, your wife has cancer and it's metastasized. But if you were a single woman, as Carson was, you weren't told. So she was told everything was fine. So she felt very, very bitter about that, because she could understand the science and she might have proceeded differently. But at any rate, she discovered she had cancer, and she was determined to finish the book before she died. So she was really racing against time. And again, her endurance is sort of kind of that of a superhero, because
right.
when she went for that interview with Eric Severide that you referred to, she was she could barely walk. She was bald. She was wearing a wig. She was enormously enervated, and she managed to get through it and to be very lucid. And then she testified before Congress, I think 6 months later,
in the same wig.
Yeah, she which is incredible. And then
yeah.
you know, she really beat she. Her doctors had given her very little time to live, and she somehow beat it back for a couple of years.
You hint at, but don't make too explicit, her sexuality. Do you think that had something to do with her reticence?
I don't. I think that, I mean, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, you know, was she married? Why didn't she marry? And the answer to that question was, she was so busy supporting her family. She was supporting her mother, her father, her two nieces, and then her niece's child. So she was supporting five people. So she had no time for any social life whatsoever. She was very shy, very socially awkward. So she didn't have sort of early successful dating experience. And then because her life was her work, the people who she relied on were her mother, who basically did all the cooking and shopping and took care of her, and her agent, and then later a woman friend who became the great love of her life. And she was, I think, gay, but it would mortify her that we were, you know,
sure.
putting her in a box
sure.
in that way. And she
well, that's what I kind of implied, was that if it had been known in any sense, that would have completely diminished her in the public.
Absolutely.
Dimension.
I mean, she would have been arrested, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, that would have been just what the chemical companies needed to you know, marginalize her. So she had to cover her cancer, and she had to, I'm sure, hide her sexuality. But she was so private that she would have been that way anyway. She would have hidden. But the love, I mean, she wrote these beautiful love letters to her friend Dorothy, and Dorothy back to her, and they did destroy a lot of the letters, so there's much we don't know.
What you quote is pretty revealing.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, and then we come to Jane Jacobs, who never shied from a microphone.
Right, she's a spitfire.
Yeah, exactly. And the consequences of her thought had very direct results in the real world, more than once. I didn't know about all three, all the three major things. I knew about two of them.
Yeah.
But basically, she saved much of Lower Manhattan.
Right.
First with the, well, you tell the story.
Well, the first...
Was she, Robert Moses in
She sure was. She was the giant killer.
I was living in New York at that time. I remember it well.
Oh, you'll have to tune in because she first became involved in local politics when she learned that Washington Square Park, that Robert Moses was going to run a highway through Washington Square Park, basically linking Fifth Avenue to West Broadway, and he had plans to put up these high-rise housing towers that were going to be Washington Square South, I think he called them. And they were going to be the new idea in luxury housing, and you could arrive very quickly by car. And his idea was he wanted highways looping across Manhattan in three or four places so that you could basically never have to get out of your car.
Can I interrupt you one second?
Yes.
I just realized we make the mistake we always make when we have a good conversation. We're talking to Andrea Barnett, the author of the new book, Visionary Women, published by Echo Press. This is the Thursday afternoon show. I'm Tom DiPietro. That's Ellen Thurston.
That's me.
And that's Andrea Barnett. Please continue.
So she got involved in fighting the road through Washington Square Park. And, you know, in those days, there was no green space downtown except Washington Square Park, beloved by the neighborhood and had a storied history. And so she wasn't. She had never really been a community activist, but she began to see that there were certain tactics. She knew a lot about the media because she was a writer. And the New York Times, she noticed, always covered the stories but always quoted Robert Moses and his minions. And so she made friends with this scrappy new newspaper called The Village Voice, which had just begun. And they seemed to like community stories, and they liked the point of view of the average citizen. So she made friends with the reporters, and she started. She had moles who were working in City Hall who would give her the lowdown, and she started to kind of undermine the New York Times's version of things by feeding these stories to the Village Voice, and the community really organized. That was the other part of her message. You realize that the written word and the spoken word, if you organized well, you could really change things. That power is not static. That power is very, very movable. And that if enough people care about things and they come together, you can really have an effect. And so they against all odds, because no one had ever beat Robert Moses at his game, they beat back the highway. And then she did the same thing. She learned that her own West Village part of the neighborhood was going to be completely leveled, bulldozed, and they were going to put up high-rise housing towers. And she organized the neighborhoods again, and they won. And then she fought very hard against the Lower Manhattan Expressway, which was going to cut through Soho on Broome Street, would have completely wiped out all those incredible cast iron buildings, historic district, which has been an economic engine of Lower Manhattan. And they beat that back. And she was really boots on the ground. She became known as someone, not only an urban activist, but, you know, incredible writer about why all of these things were important. But she put her feet where her mouth was. She was right out on the front of the barricades, and very savvy about, she'd organize kids to, she called them little elves, to put up, you know, posters and get people to sign petitions. Because in those days, the long shadow of McCarthyism was still, could still be felt, and people were afraid to sign things. But when children asked them and said, you know, will you save our park, or our neighborhood is going to be knocked down, will you sign? She was really smart about all that.
My own involvement in local politics was definitely inspired by reading Death and Life of American Cities, as well as The Power Broker by Robert Caro, who tells the Moses side of it. a man who had 45 years of power and never been elected to public office.
Right. And he had something like 20 different appointments that he had simultaneously. Yeah.
And you see from the Jane Jacobs struggle that even if it wasn't him, he had plenty of operatives out there who were doing his bidding.
Right.
Amazing.
I know. Amazing. And she says that, because it's interesting, in The Power Broker, she's not mentioned, but The Power Broker was 300 pages longer. And I think that she was cut because, just for expedience sake, but she said when she read The Power Broker, she was shocked because Moses was even worse than she had thought, which is pretty bad. And then she finally got, we should say that in 1968, she ended up leaving New York because she was fighting Lower Manhattan Expressway. And there was a rally that she'd helped organize. And there were, 100 citizens at, and they all stood up and kind of stormed the stage. She was the only one arrested of all the people there. And she was booked. And when she went to court, she was told she might get a year in prison or longer. And the neighborhood rallied, raised money, and she was able to finally fight it after 3 or 4 months of trials. But she realized that she'd been fighting civic battles for 6 or 8 years, and she was no longer had the time to do her writing. And also her sons, the whole family was against the Vietnam War. They were actively part of the protest movement, and she realized she didn't want her sons drafted. So she moved to Canada, to Toronto, in summer of 1968, which was a great loss for the village. But immediately she started to fight the same battles in Toronto that she'd been fighting in New York.
We're talking to Andrea Barnett, the author of Visionary Women, just out two months ago from Echo Press. In your epilogue, you talk about the four women as progressives, but it occurs to me what really kind of links them is that they looked at so-called progress and said, stop.
Right. Right.
That in a literal sense, they were not progressive, or let's say that they were not in favor of what was being called progress, whether it was in Rachel Carson's case, progress was getting rid of disease throughout the world. In James Jacobs' case, it was putting up housing for the poor. And it goes on. Alice Waters' case, it's about industrial agriculture as opposed to localism.
They were all preservationists. They were all trying to look at the world and preserve systems that they saw were really important and viable. And what they recognized was, what they were against was science-based technological progress where mankind was going in and bending and manipulating nature, re-engineering nature. Industrial agriculture was based upon the idea that you could speed things up using synthetic fertilizers and chemicals. Pesticides were going to eliminate all bugs and somehow without any understanding of the context of that the entire system would be impacted by these poisons. Jane Jacobs also said, is progress really highways through every city, crisscrossing through every city, and knocking down old neighborhoods that make people
only if you think everybody needs to get to the suburbs quickly,
really quickly, yeah, and only if you think you don't need a sense of place or a sense of scale. All of them were seeing that the human scale and the quality of life was being cheapened by these so-called implements of progress. So they weren't so much anti-progress as anti industrial technology being visited upon nature. And Jacobs wrote about cities as natural ecosystems. Mm-hmm. She said humans were the living creatures in cities, but they operated in the same way that the natural world did, and that the human quotient was enormously important. And if you wipe that out, if you wiped out the street life, you wiped out the ecology of the city.
We had an urban designer in here a couple of weeks ago who's just written a book called 101 Things I Learned in Urban Design School. And there's only 3 quotations in the entire book, and one of them is, of course, from Jane Jacobs. So her work has endured amongst urban planners and designers.
It's incredible. No urban planner or architecture student goes through his or her schooling without having read Jane Jacobs' mm-hmm. Life and Death of Great American Cities.
I want to ask you a little bit about how your book came about, because, for example, Jane Goodall isn't an American.
Right.
How did you sort of, in your mind, I mean, I could see how you see thematically how she's there, but was she part of the design from the start?
She was part of the design from the start because she so radically changed the way zoology was practiced and thought of and animals were conceived of. And I was really looking for women who had had enormous impact and who were preservationists, as I said, who were outsiders, uncredentialed. And, you know, the only place she doesn't fit is she's not American, but she, her impact, strangely enough, she, well, it's not strange, she ended up teaching at Stanford for a while. And her work first appeared in National Geographic, which is an American magazine, and it was funded by Americans. So she has that attachment. But what I was looking for is, what I was interested in, it was the same period of time. It was a time when the culture was really changing. And I don't think women's voices would have been heard before. I mean, one of the things I write about is we forget how restricted things were for women in 1962. I was really shocked the more I read. There were still headmaster laws on the books that a wife was subject to her husband's will. If a woman owned property, as soon as she got married, it was her husband's. He could rent it, he could sell it. The income was his. If she she in many states she couldn't be on jury duty because she'd be neglecting her domestic duties. There were states in Pennsylvania, believe it or not, there was a law in the book that you couldn't beat a woman on Sunday after 10. The idea being before 10, it's fair game. So,
well, by after 10, you've gone to church and you know better,
right? You'd be asleep. But so the fact that these women that women would be listened to was just something so unusual.
Which begs the question, which you do answer in your book, why not Betty Friedan?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, what I say is that all four of the women I write about were trying to preserve endangered systems and endangered parts of the culture. That for Alice Waters, she saw that food and eating and the family meal and healthy, nourishing food was disappearing because of industrial agriculture. For Carson, she saw that the natural world was being completely polluted. And Jane Jacobs saw that cities were being destroyed. So the thing with Betty Friedan is she also was a revolutionary. She was also somewhat of an outsider. But she was trying to blow up a system that was pinching to the human psyche, blow it up whole cloth. The others were trying to preserve systems they saw as endangered. So she doesn't fit as a green thinker.
Right. Did you decide that at the get-go?
I did. Because, I mean, her timing is exactly the same.
Right.
I mean, Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring in 62. Jane Jacobs wrote Death and Life of Great American Cities in 61. And Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique in 63. I mean, it's perfectly aligned, except for the fact that she was, rightly so, trying to destroy a system that was so hobbling to women. And the rest of them were really trying to look at the world and save what they saw as deeply endangered.
I mentioned the Michelle Dean book earlier, which I can't remember the title of it. Smart Women or something?
No, it's called Sharp.
Sharp Women. Couple of those figures in there kind of work the edges of what you're talking about, maybe. Did you ever consider more literary types? Or is that too far afield?
No, it's too far afield because I was really looking for preservationists, green thinkers. I mean, that would have been a bigger
book.
And as it was, four people was a lot.
Yeah.
To try to tie together. And
so let's get to the last figure, Alice Waters, who comes later. Certainly fits into your green paradigm. But do you really think she's the game changer?
I think she is a major game changer, but her timing is a little bit later. That's the only really forced part of the book, I would say, because she, all of the other
still
women.
Still very enjoyable, don't
good,
worry.
Good, thank you. All of the other women.
Because she got to talk to a lot of people who knew her.
Yeah, yeah, that was, well, and she's great. And yeah.
Ellen saw her speak here, you know. She spoke here recently.
She's been
not
here.
Recently, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, she was here and her presence was really felt.
And I don't know if you know that Mona Talbot, who you mentioned in the book,
I do know,
has
a
shop right here too.
Yeah, so. I love Mona's shop. Oh. Adore it. And in fact, Alice is so charismatic. She's someone you really feel when you meet her, you'd follow her anywhere. She's an incredible organizer and incredibly good at collaborating and a real visionary. The reason she's a little bit forced is her dates are a little later, in that all of the other women have their breakthrough moments in the 60s and early 60s. She went to France in 1965, fell in love with food in France, and came back to Berkeley and wanted to recreate the experience of really delicious food at table where people sat for a long time and had conversation. She realized that conversation and community began over food, and that food was much more than just a frippery. It wasn't just an indulgence. And so Chez Panisse started in 1970, and she really didn't find her mission until another decade later. Because initially she was really, it was very, very much, she just wanted to have a clubhouse for her friends to come and eat good food. And as time went on, she became more and more political about it. She realized that food is political and that right. She was fighting against Big Ag.
The first iteration seems more just a Francophile dream.
Right.
And
right.
then it becomes something more
right.
significant.
Right. But I still feel she was enormously important because what she did is she gave people an experience that they hadn't had really probably since before the war, and maybe if they'd had it all, which was really, really good food. And she changed people's minds by appealing to their senses. I mean, people who went to Chez Panisse, it was a revelation. It was French food, simple bistro food, and it was delicious, and it was in a casual place. There were fancy French restaurants in some cities, but they were always very haughty and mm-hmm. very, very sort of stylized, and they were off-putting, and this was for everyone. And so the thing is that now farm to table has been spread so much that mm-hmm. You know, we forget, but she's really the first one who recognized the connections between the restaurateur, the farmer, the consumer, the farmer. There weren't even very many. There were very few farm markets mm-hmm. when she started. And she was in California, but certainly none in the East. And now yeah. every city has a farmer's market.
Of course, one thing I thought to myself reading that section is when, you know, you're talking about lack of access and all this stuff. That, well, frankly, in this little Italian neighborhood in the Bronx, you could get all this stuff.
Right. You know, it's funny. I've been going to, I've been invited to a few book clubs. And mm-hmm. what's been so interesting is everyone who grew up in an ethnic neighborhood in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s says,
that.
Oh, but in my neighborhood, we could get
that's
that.
Right, exactly.
So, but one of the things that was happening because of TV and because of industrial food, those ma and pop places were getting run out of cities and run out of everywhere, and also children of immigrants didn't want to eat their mother's delicious home.
Well, that's what I was
food.
Just going to say. My mother's father was in the produce business, and yet my mother would buy frozen and canned things, and it's like, are you crazy? We have all this access
right.
to incredible
right.
stuff.
Kids saw it on TV yeah. and they
right.
wanted frozen pizza, even though their parents could make, you know, pizza from scratch.
Yeah.
And they wanted all this fake food, you know. Pringles have there's nothing there's nothing natural about a Pringle. Creamer, so there's no milk or cream or anything having dairy in creamer. I mean, there's fruit juices with all fake flavors and all high
fructose.
Fructose, yeah.
And corn syrup.
Yeah, corn syrup. And so Alice was the first one to sort of say, this is not the direction we need to go. And it caught on really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
She was aided by the fact that the 60s, the counterculture already was very suspicious of industrialized everything. And many people in the counterculture had traveled on pennies to Europe and to the Far East. And so they came back with more sophisticated palates. And so it was the right time. There was an audience for the kind of food Alice was promoting.
I was thinking a couple of the other sort of important moments in that period in terms of food, in terms of hippie food, like the Moosewood,
right,
whatever
right.
that was called.
Cookbook, yeah.
But, you know, that food was pretty awful.
It was awful. And Alice says that. One of the things that's really funny when I spoke to her is she said, you know, I hated those early organic, produce stores. They smelled medicinal. The food mm-hmm. was always really oversized and bruised and dry looking, and it had no taste. And you know, hippies had the right idea, but they hadn't really refined mm-hmm. how to raise the crops. And she said, I wanted to have nothing to do with that. She said the bread was always really hard. What she wanted to do was, what she began to realize was that she was initially searching for food that had great taste and produce that had great taste. Mm-hmm. And gradually she came to see that the food that had the best taste was that that had been raised responsibly without mm-hmm. chemicals. And she began to see the connections between a healthy agriculture and healthy food and good tasting food. So she really came at it through firsthand experience.
And a point you make that we've made here on the air numerous times in our food conversations is that it may seem all kind of elitist and the whole move towards natural foods and organic food, but as Michael Pollan has pointed out, it's that junk food is in effect subsidized in the way that it's produced, and both also by the government. The government gives enormous subsidies to corn production to make the corn syrup and fructose and all that stuff.
Right.
It's an unnatural. It's a skewed market.
Right, right. That's absolutely true. And as Alice says, there's nothing radical about organic food. Before the 40s, all food was organic. It was not until the refrigerated boxcar and all of these chemicals that food started to be industrialized. And so all she was advocating was going back to something that we'd lost, which is very different. And the big ag, though, is such a powerful, powerful political arm.
We don't have much more time, but seems to me that what also links these four women is just a willingness to give into common sense. You know, I mean, where the males of the time were the main respected thinkers of the time were so wrapped up in theory and ideology that they weren't just observing.
Right.
And reacting in that way.
Right.
And I guess that's sort of what you said.
Yeah, absolutely.
Earlier and in the book. That's clear. You make that clear throughout the entire book, I should make clear. Anyway, we're running out of time. This has been great. We've been talking to Andrea Barnett. Ellen, you've been really way too...
You've been really verbose.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. I haven't read the book.
Really?
Yes, because, other people were reading it.
Oh, yeah, blame me. Well, that's how this goes. Anything wrong, I get the blame.
I didn't name names.
Who else had a copy? But, Andrea, thank you for coming in.
How many minutes do we have?
About a minute
or two. I just wanted to say thanks. Ahead. This has been fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure.
And Andrea, I wondered how many years you devoted to writing this book.
Five long years.
Oh,
and
wow.
Working every day on the weekends because I was so worried I wouldn't get it done.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't have more time to talk about your career as a writer before this because I know you have another book about Greenwich Village. Harlem and Greenwich Village in the 30s, which is another topic that I'm interested in.
Oh, you have to come back.
Yeah.
I'll come back.
Yeah. Andrea Barnett, the book is Visionary Women, Four Women Who Changed the World, Rachel Carson, Jane Jacobs, Jane Goodall, and Alice Waters. It's available from Echo Press in hardcover. It'll probably be in paperback eventually.
I think it will, probably a year from now.
Yeah, now that you don't have a contract.
You'll
get it. are you touring anywhere with
I'm touring like crazy, yeah.
Oh, good.
I just was in L.A.
Oh.
And maybe I should close with one great anecdote.
Sure.
I was on a panel called Writing Great Lives, and it was some really heavy-hitting biographers.
Mm-hmm.
One guy who'd just done a biography of Nixon and one new biography of Muhammad Ali. And we were talking about the fact that always in a biography, a huge amount of what you learn ends up on the cutting room floor. So they were telling stories that didn't make it into the book that were really funny. So my story was that Jane Goodall had been asked to speak before a group of police in L.A. And she was told at the last minute, she was really, really nervous. She got to the room and she could see all these cops were in no way interested in hearing this woman talk about primates. They're all kind of looking down at their laps. And she thought, okay, well, I've got to do something to get their attention. So she said, well, if I was a female primate and I was surrounded as I am now by all these alpha males, the natural thing to do would be to show my genitals. I wish everyone perked up and paid attention.
Yeah, no, she was frank. I remember that one quotation about what she observed. She didn't show any kind of
squeamishness.
Squeamishness, that's the word. Well, once again, thank you, Andrea Barnett, the author of Visionary Women, for coming in and joining us today.